From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, County Executive Chris Abley discusses a state bill that would make changes to the county's mental health complex. Then a Milwaukee woman shares her love for the county's parks and green spaces in a new book.
Started out like most moms with parks and playgrounds and picnics. But as we got out into the parks, we discovered that there were lagoons and beautiful trees and birds and bicycles and trails. And it just seemed like every time we got into a park, we discovered something new.
An award-winning Israeli screenwriter and novelist Ron Lesham extols the generosity of a place that's not usually known for it.
I never expected Hollywood to be so open-minded to hearing ideas, so reachable, so you can get to anyone you want, you can tell and share stories, and we found some amazing partners there.
It's all coming up on Lake Effect. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio, and I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. Some state lawmakers are pledging that action will still be taken this session to reform Milwaukee County's embattled mental health system. Several Republican legislators have said they're fast-tracking a measure that would take control away from the County Board of Supervisors and transfer it to an appointed board of mainly medical and mental health professionals. The bill has support from some Democrats as well. They say the measure is needed to better avoid situations like a December death of a man being held at the complex and an earlier study showing medical care at the center to be lacking. But critics of the bill say it wouldn't take politics out of the equation, but would merely change which politicians have oversight. Chris Abley is Milwaukee County Executive. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke and offered his thoughts on the proposed changes to how mental health care is delivered in the county.
For 3 years, I've been working hard and with the leadership of Hector Colon, our DHHS director, to reform the Behavioral Health Division. I don't think it's a secret to any of your listeners. You know, you have decades of studies talking about what we need to do, which is move towards more community-based care. And for 3 years, even with budgets that started with big deficits, we've still put millions more in the budget to start building capacity for community-based care. And honestly, anything that will allow us to do right by the people we serve and their families sooner and faster is not just something I'm enthusiastic about. It's our moral obligation. We don't get to say we had no idea. Decades of studies. And it should be pointed out that by changing the oversight board here to being made up instead of elected officials to medical professionals, that's not making us an outlier. We are an outlier. Right now we're the only one comprised of entirely elected officials. This is just bringing us in line with kind of what best practice is everywhere. I don't think it's a particularly ideological thing. Every blue state in the country does this. Every state in the country except for us. Dane County is a nationally well-respected model, and that's the direction we want to head in. And so I'm excited about it.
Is there any way to completely eliminate politics from the oversight process? I mean, some people would say that this takes the political oversight out of the hands of the county board. But at some level, there is still political oversight in who gets to appoint the community-based mental health professional and medical professional-based board.
Sure, to some degree. I mean, I think that the thing to be looking at is the outcome for the people we're serving. And I'll start by just looking at the organizations that provide this service effectively. And the good news for Milwaukee, if the bad news is we've waited a long time to do what the rest of the country does here and how they provide service. The good news is we have no shortage of models to look at for what does work. And what we're doing is moving towards a model that resembles the one that do work. Oversight by medically licensed professionals. So there's still checks and balances by people who understand the fields, the management of hospitals, mental illness, et cetera. So I think it's a good thing.
It's hard to remove politics entirely. There are some who say that this looks like a positive step, but it needs to be vetted more than is likely to happen in an election year.
Sure. I suppose so. I guess my concern about that is the families and the consumers at the Behavioral Health Division have been waiting for 30 years. it is not the case that we just discovered we need to move to a better model. This has been pointed out in study after study after study for decades. So when people say we're moving too fast, I guess I ask, for whom? Certainly not for the families and the consumers. You know, what is too soon? And importantly, it's not the case that if this bill passes, I will do – in all cases, if it passes, if it doesn't pass, I'm still going to do everything I can and work as hard as I can to improve care for the people we serve. That's our moral obligation. In all cases, I will still continue to look for anything I can do, legislative or otherwise, to improve our ability to provide the service. I'm less concerned about, you know, who gets credit or what sort of the political implications are than I am with delivering quality service that impacts people's lives. We've got to get out of the out of the business of the institutionalized care where you've got people who've been institutionalized for decades. And into a delivery model that resembles what the rest of the country does.
Do you think this current county board is any more or less to blame than those who have come before? As you say, this has been an issue for, you know, not just the last year, but probably the last 30 years.
Yeah, I don't think it's an issue of blame. I spend a lot of time being asked about all sorts of policy differences I have with and we all have, you know, whether it's in the congressional level or city level or county level, state level, whatever. I mean, we all have differences. But the goal is not who wins, who loses. The goal isn't who gets a press conference. The goal is, in this case, decent, respectful care with dignity. Lives that are as empowered and allow for as much freedom as we can provide. That's the only thing I'm looking at. And I'd rather apologize for getting there in a way that, you know, if somebody has an issue about, you know, how it looked or whatever, then apologize for being indifferent and not changing the care that we have now because we can do better. And yes, we've got great people there, but it's not about fault or blame. It's just about, you know, stop looking for enemies and arguments and victories and start looking for solutions, and we've got one. And I just you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people who are frustrated that it's taken this long for this discussion to reach this level. But there will be a lot of people happy, I think, when we improve care, and I'm committed to doing that.
Let's move to the living wage ordinance passed by the county board. You have been sharply critical of the measure, which would set the minimum wage for county workers and contractors at $11.32 an hour. Have you decided whether you will veto it?
Well, as I've explained to the board, I support the federal minimum wage at $10.10. My concern has been this, that first, if you apply any wage mandate locally and you create, among other things, whether or not this is the goal, one impact is you create competition between us and, say, Waukesha and people that we shouldn't be competing with, we should be working together with. Second, I don't want to do anything at the county level that impedes our ability to deliver the other services that are crucial. So, for instance, applying it to family care, the people we serve with family care fall in that category of the most vulnerable that I take my responsibility to most seriously. And so the notion that all of a sudden we're going to have to come up with on about $5 million a year more in the absence of anybody telling me where, you know, you want to cut some bus routes or meal programs or fall back on, you know, parks maintenance, courts, DAs, everything's important. And, you know, it's not a game, I guess. And I've encouraged the supervisors, and I know some of them feel the same way. Look, nobody's pro-poverty. I've worked very hard to keep bus fares low, to lower them for paratransit, to add programming at the House of Correction. Within the services we are currently delivering at county, I've focused as much as I can to on every opportunity we have to empower people. But I've been doing it in a way that doesn't require cuts to other things. And I think sometimes we lose focus on the goal when we start talking about a tactic. And again, you know, I'm I continue to support the federal minimum wage, but I don't think, as I've seen it, I don't think this is a good idea.
You stopped short, though, in that answer of saying yes or no to a veto, and at this point, you're just not ready to say?
Well, I'll probably veto it. My only hesitance is just that, you know, first it may not be an issue because I understand another bill was introduced at the state level that may pertain to this and living wages generally, and just encourage that where they happen, they're statewide, which, you know, a statewide one I would also support. Secondly, the focus should be about not sort of what the disagreement is. You know, I hate even getting to veto. The reason in the course of this discussion I met with Supervisor Bowen, SEIU, Wisconsin Jobs Now, many of the groups that were involved in drafting it many times, and I said I would meet with absolutely anybody. In all cases, I said, look, here's the other things we're doing to address this that don't have costs. I didn't just say no. I said, look, if you can come up with a solution to address the issue that doesn't hurt our ability to, you know, keep buses running so people can get to their jobs and can get to school, great. Or join me in supporting Mike Lovell at UWM and getting more than 2/3 per student what UW-Madison does. And don't think that doesn't have an impact on jobs. It does. But people weren't all that interested in it. They were sort of focused on this. And again, you know, nobody disagrees. We should all do everything we can to address poverty, but we should do it responsibly, and that means in a sustainable way.
Would you agree, though, that there are probably some county workers out there, many maybe, in fact, who at their current wage are having difficulty making ends meet?
Well, in the county, we've got 1 million people. We have about 4,400 employees. I think the number of county employees that would be impacted by in terms of the wage, an increased wage, is relatively small. I think it's a couple hundred, if that. But I can tell you that the current one would cost $5 million. That's not me. That's the comptroller, about $5 million a year to family care. And you know, I guess that to me, the question I'd ask is, why is everybody so ready to cost $5 million to a population that is easily as vulnerable as who they're trying to help with the living wage? And I'll just say it again. I support the federal minimum wage at any time. I've offered to the supervisors, hey, join me in supporting and advocating for that. Join me in, you know, a lot of the other programs we do that are proven, that absolutely impact, that empower, you know, I mean, all the alternative program we have at the House of Corrections, we never had before. We serve more people through child support, deliver more checks to more single parents than we ever did before. We've kept fares down for transit. We haven't cut routes. All of those things are real. They're what we do. They're responsible, a much larger scale, and they don't come at the cost of $5 million to family care. I guess my question is, if we actually care about addressing poverty, we approach it in the most sustainable way possible without costing the 1 million people in the county another $5 million.
One more topic. When we spoke last, I think it was the last time we spoke anyway, you made the point that the plan to shift responsibility for operating Milwaukee County Transit from MTS to MV Transportation was not changing, but was just basically being delayed. Is that still the case?
Well, there's still an appeals process right now. Obviously, I remain enthusiastic about the MV, the selected vendor. I don't think there's anybody listening right now who know I mean, I think we're all aware the state has cut our transit funding. So the funding we get from the state to provide bus routes and keep the fares low was cut. Some of it was restored. For that, I'm grateful. MV's proposal would allow us to put $15 million a year more into service. And to be very clear, the goal was never, hey, save us a bunch of money and it comes back to the house. It's save us $15 million a year, and that gets pushed back into more service, more routes, and keeping fares low. And, you know, people can have their own opinions about where MTS is now, but I get concerned when I was concerned with the $8 million extra we had to spend on a contract for paratransit that was mishandled. I get concerned when I see reports about, you know, stops being missed or drivers speeding or people relieving themselves on buses. Do we want to spend $15 million more to maintain that? Or do we want to give ourselves $15 million? And by the way, under a contract that protects the county more. All I can say is, like most decisions I make at the county, my focus is just about always trying to deliver the best value, the least risk, the most sustainable, highest quality service on everything we do. That's at least the goal going into everything. And I think most people would look at $15 million more per year for transit and feel pretty good about it.
There are some who have concerns that the contract wouldn't prevent MV from making major cuts to say, driver salaries at the expense of everything else. Are there guarantees that this contract could provide? Or, how do you answer the criticism that's been leveled about even the bidding process itself?
Sure. Well, most of the criticism, to be very clear, has come from the failed bidders. Contract letting 101, when you put out any kind of bid for contract, when people don't win the contract, not everybody behaves well. My goal isn't to make everybody happy. The people I have to make happy are you, taxpayers and the people who use the transit system. MV has said they will honor the ATU contracts, but just to be clear, that's a couple hundred drivers, and there's great people, no doubt about it. They've said they've honored their contracts. They've said and committed to sharing. There's the way the contract's structured, where they beat goals, there'd be profit sharing with the drivers. So that's something more than what the drivers had. But let's not lose sight of the fact that 36,000 people every day use the bus just to get to work. That's just to get to work. So 400 drivers get to keep, or whatever the, a couple hundred drivers get to keep the salary they're at, potentially share in profit, and $15 million more in service. So if you're asking, am I focused on the $15 million more in service for the many, many, many thousands of riders every day? Yes, I am.
Well, Chris Abele, thanks so much.
Great to be on.
Chris Abele is Milwaukee County Executive. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. Coming up next, Sheridan Park is celebrating its 100th birthday. WUWM's Susan Bentz takes us there next when Lake Effect returns. You're listening to us on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Among the jewels that are in the Milwaukee County Park System, there is a 132-acre parcel, the shape of which some liken to a sleeping dinosaur. It's called Sheridan Park, and it's situated along Lake Michigan in Cudahy. Supporters and officials are kicking off its centennial this week at the Pulaski Inn. Antoinette Vanook, who's with the Sheridan Park Friends Group, says it's just the beginning of a year of celebration. Vanook met WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz at Sheridan Park next to its ice skating rink, inside what some call the warming house. Vanook prefers the term pavilion. She grew up in Cudahy, raised her family here, and today lives within eyeshot of the park. Bentz and Vanook were also joined by photographer and writer Barbara Ali, a Milwaukee resident who recently wrote 101 Things to Do in Milwaukee Parks. Vanook kicks off their conversation, recalling early memories of Sheridan Park.
I didn't live as close to the park as I do now, and so our trips to the park were a little bit farther and fewer between, but when we came, we would be here for the whole day. So if we went to the pool to go swimming, we would end up staying afterwards and play in the park until it got dark and until it had to be time to go home. Then as a teenager, I lived a block and a half away from the park, and so we spent a lot of time in this building, warming up and on the ice, falling down. And then as an adult, after we got married and we had our children, we would come here. The Cudahy 4th of July parade ends here every single year. And so this place is just awash in people. You can't park six blocks away from the park. It's that packed. They have games for kids. They have food. The Lions Club have stuff set up. The city puts up a stage. Parks provide the venue, and the city provides everything else. And this year, because of the centennial, they always pick a different theme every year. Part of the theme of the parade is the Sheridan Park Centennial.
When summer does come,
yes. Yes. It amazes me. The fact that I live kitty corner from what I refer to as the pond, we see weddings here on weekends, and people coming in and standing up on the hill and up on the bluff up there getting their pictures taken. I've walked my dog through the park, and you know, this pavilion on weekends, usually during the summertime, has got somebody doing something every single weekend. You have picnic areas. I think there's 5 designated picnic areas, and there's always signs at every single one of them where the spots are reserved. People say to me, you have this huge house, and there's just you and your husband. Why do you still own this huge house? You should go into a condo, you should go in an apartment, type of thing. Well, we have 4 children. We have 7 grandchildren, all 6 years and younger. And so when they all come to visit, this is the first place we all go. Even during the winter, we watched our grandsons a year ago over the Christmas holidays, and we brought them into the park, and they trudged around in the snow, and they thought it was so neat because it had just started to freeze. We didn't have a lot of snow then, and we walked them along the edge of the lagoon, and they could actually see through the ice, and they just thought that was the neatest thing. And, you know, if you don't have parks, you can't do that.
When did you become an official?
We started this 2009, 2010, and it started out with just a half a dozen women and my husband.
What brought you together? What was the issue?
The fact that a lot of us walk our pets through the park, and we were tired of the fact that things were a mess. Nothing was cleaned up. Nobody was doing anything. One of the great things about friends groups is they work as a partner with the parks department. They try to pick up where the parks department can't be. At one time when I was, as I was saying before, when I was a kid and I spent time in the parks, you always had dedicated people who were the people who were in the park every single day. You knew their name, they knew your name. They were here all the time. Pavilions were open all the time. The swimming pool was open in the morning, in the afternoon, and in the evening. It closed for an hour at lunch and an hour at supper time, and that was it. Well, because of budget constraints, because of lack of workers, et cetera, a lot of that has had to change. You now have these people having to work their way through 5 or 6 or 7 different parks. We try to be the eyes and the ears that they can't have here at all times. We've been known to walk around with plastic bags, not only to pick up after our pets, but to pick up garbage and trash. At one time, during the winter, the parks departments would pick up, at the first sign of snow, would pick up all of the trash cans and would take them and put them away because no one was using the parks. Why do you want to leave trash cans out? I mean, they can blow around, they can get damaged. And as the parks started being used more and we started noticing the 1 or 2 places where we could find a trash can, they were being filled to the brim, we would contact the park and we'd say, hey, look, is there any chance we could get a trash can over by the pavilion, or can we get a trash can over by the pond? And so they've done that. As a result, the parks are cleaner. We do that type of thing. A couple of months ago, I called Matt Collins, who's in charge of this area, to let him know that walking my dog, I noticed one of the windows was broken. Not only was the screen down and torn, the window was open, and of course, I wasn't about to come over here. So I informed him. We found out that someone had broken in. So that's what I meant by we're the eyes and the ears for the parks. We try to help them out as much as we can.
What do you want for this park, and what makes it hard to, you know, keep things?
What makes it hard to do anything is the lack of volunteers and the lack of money. We have lots of things that we would like to see done here. We just recently, and when I say we, I mean collectively, a collective we, not the Sheridan Park Friends. We acquired a $66,000 grant to improve things here at the park. And that money is going directly to the parks department, and then they will be the ones that will be either doing the work or hiring the people to do the work. We're hoping they will work on the roof and the rain gutters and the windows. And then long-term dream would be that if we could, would be to get the inside updated a little bit. And by that I mean, because this building is rented out for birthday parties and weddings and things, it would be ideal if we could somehow get a kitchen counter with a sink. And, you know, a place where people, you know, maybe a microwave, something where people could actually have a full-blown party and not worry about, well, how am I going to keep this warm, or how am I going to clean things up? You know, so that's kind of one of our wish lists. There's several areas along the edge here that are beautiful view sheds that it would just be a matter of getting the right people in here to clear away some specific areas so that you could put some benches in and then people could sit in, because there is a lot of traffic out there with ships and regular boats and and fairies and the whole ball of wax. We're actually in a migration line, and so a lot of bird watchers come to Sheridan Park.
So Barbara Ali wrote a book about Milwaukee's green spaces, including Sheridan. So you've mentioned some of the things in this park in your book, including ice skating.
Right, you can ice skate, and the sunrise is fantastic from the shore, if you can risk it, heading down that S road like you talked about.
You've taken the S.
I have, yes, and it's pretty slippery this time of year, but it's worth it. It's beautiful.
What started your adventure in exploring Milwaukee's green spaces, including this park?
Well, I had a son with Down syndrome, and I joined a park group, and every Friday we would meet at a different park during the summer. So it started out like most moms with parks and playgrounds and picnics. But as we got out into the parks, we discovered that there were lagoons and beautiful trees and birds and bicycles and trails. And it just seemed like every time we got into a park, we discovered something new. And there were so many things, even though we had lived all over the world, that made me go, wow, what a great place this is. And then we started to investigate how many parks there were. And each place was a little bit different. And it just gives you a wide variety here in Milwaukee. We are very fortunate.
So how long was this book in the making?
Well, I had been writing a blog for just over a year, so I had a lot of information and a lot of photographs. And then just putting it all together took about a month.
Wow.
It's amazing when your kids are in school and your husband goes on a business trip, how driven you can be to use that time that you have that's quiet. So that's what happened, and that's how it happened.
So what's some, and you don't have to say Sheridan just because we're here, mm-hmm. but what are some of your favorite finds or, you know, real treasures that you treasure?
Well, I think if you've ever been to South Shore Park on a Saturday morning, there is just nothing like it. There's the farmer's market and music and stunning views and a little free library and playground. And there's just such a sense of community. And I think that's what keeps people coming back to parks like that. It's not just the green space. It's the community gathering there that makes it wonderful.
The photography in your book is lovely. And you decided on all black and white. Was that a cost issue or just sheer beauty?
It is, right. I want my book to be a resource guide. I want it to be something you keep in the glove box or in your backpack and write notes in. And I mean, it's meant to be used. It's not meant to be a coffee table book. And in order to keep the costs down, the pictures had to be in black and white.
They're beautiful, though.
Thank you.
Are there any of this park?
Yes, actually, the Oak Leaf Trail goes through here.
That's right.
The Oak Leaf Discovery Tour and the ice skating, the lagoon she mentioned. So there are quite a few facilities inside of the book that would pertain to Sheridan Park. It's a lovely park.
Yeah. So what you do is you take the reader alphabetically by activity.
Right.
How did you decide to take that approach?
Well, I think there are some great resources out there already that tell you where the parks are, and they tell you what is in the park. But what I find is that people don't have an idea of the variety of activities that can be done here. And I think a lot of them you don't discover unless you're there at a certain time or a member of a group. And this is a perfect blend of concessions and volunteers and park facilities in this area. So this kind of leads you to those concessions and the activities that are led by volunteers.
Something that happens in other parks is yoga.
Right, right. They do have yoga. And sometimes during the summer, it's even outdoors. There is down by Bradford Beach and at Lake Park. And then there are a few who do it indoors in places just like the building that we're in right now. It's normally an instructor who will do it for a fee, and you pay per class. And the great thing is that while you're doing yoga and waking up your muscles, you have these stunning views. You can look out and watch the sunrise at Lake Park while you're doing yoga. And, of course, it's wonderful during the summer just to be outdoors with other people and hearing the sounds of nature.
You're having a celebration Friday.
Friday night we're having the centennial dinner. And then on the 22nd of February, they're having the Yeti Dash and Fat Tire Race. Yeah, the following Saturday. And then all of the grade schools are doing projects for Sheridan Park. And then the Cudahy Rec Department is going to have an Easter egg hunt here in Sheridan Park on April 12th. And so they're holding it here. And then the 4th of July celebration. They're trying to do something every month all the way for a year.
Antoinette Vanuk is vice chair of Sheridan Park Friends. Barbara Ali is the author of 101 Things to Do in Milwaukee Parks. They spoke with Susan Bentz. Sheridan Park Friends is helping to kick off a year of celebration, marking the park's 100th birthday this Friday. You'll find out more about both Sheridan Centennial and Ali's book on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We're all tired of the cold, but for some of us, it's tougher than others. Essayist Gerianne Haslett joins us next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. This winter has seemed never-ending, and most of us are pretty tired of the cold. But Lake Effect essayist Gerianne Haslett got to thinking about the people for whom the cold weather is more than just inconvenient.
Wisconsin's recent spate of frigid weather took me back to a blisteringly cold day last winter when I was leaving an office in a downtown high-rise. As I passed a young man in a first-floor corridor, which contained some retail shops and a cafe, he turned and said, "Do you have 75 cents you could let me have? I'm trying to catch the bus." I was struck by his face. Angelic is what came to mind. Round, sweet, boyish, not yet hardened by life's vagaries and injustices. His eyes were glistening, and he flashed an expectant half-smile. I gave him the stock answer I had honed during the many years I lived and worked in Los Angeles, where panhandling is ubiquitous. "I'm sorry," I said. "I don't have any money with me." He turned and walked away, a knit cap pulled low over his ears, and bundled in so many layers he waddled. I was shocked as I hurried toward the parking structure. "Why did I say that?" I wondered as shame crept up my neck. "What is wrong with me? 75 cents. That's all he asked for. 75 cents. I kept on going, my legs working like sticks of wood. He was even specific about what he wanted it for, an inner voice chided. I had the money, maybe not the exact change he asked for, but a few dollar bills, and I could have easily given him one. I still could. I could run back and do it. But no, that would expose my fib. "But isn't that the ploy?" another voice chimed in. 75 cents from you, 50 cents from somebody else, it adds up. Some panhandlers do pretty well, and it's a lot easier than getting a real job." "What?" the first voice shot back. "You think he'd rather be out here in this god-awful cold than filling orders at a burger joint, or that it's easier to beg money from strangers than to pick up trash dropped by mall shoppers? Did he really look like he was doing pretty well?" Pushing through the parking structure door, I thought about the great scold I am about people in this country not wanting to take care of others, about those who disparage social safety nets and say we shouldn't be a nanny state. Was being a hypocrite any better? With my car in sight, I remembered a plastic bag of quarters in the glove compartment for parking meters and toll roads. No matter what, I decided, that man could use 75 cents a lot more than I would miss it. With that bag of quarters, I could save face and help him with bus fare at the same time. But would I be able to find him? I decided to try. Bag in hand, I hustled back into the building and scanned the long corridor stretching a city block ahead. No sign of a dark, waddling figure. I pressed on, knowing that the end of the corridor intersected with another one on the left. I reached it and turned, wondering how far I was willing to go before I would give up, when I spotted him a couple of hundred yards ahead. I quickened my pace and finally drew close enough to say, "Excuse me." He turned, surprised. "I'd like you to have this," I said, and handed him the bag. He looked even more surprised. I couldn't think of anything else to say, so I turned and left, feeling good. Mission accomplished. On the way back to my car, though, my steps slowed as a poem called Convicted popped into my head. I had written it years earlier, after passing, day after day, a small patch of green near my workplace in Los Angeles, where homeless men sat or stretched out in the warming sunshine and smoked cigarettes. It goes like this. I saw him there in grease-stained jeans, with grizzled chin and gaunt cheeks creased. He rummaged through the garbage can, with hunger shaking at his hand. Man, how glad I am no one required I take a stand. Oh, I could have handed him some bread. I had the dough. But who's to know he wouldn't blow it on Jim Beam or extra smokes. No, I wash my hands of that bad blood. The streetlights wink. I think by dawn his form should fade. Well, many dawns have passed since that day last winter. But for me, that young man's form has yet to fade.
Lake Effect essayist Gerri-Ann Hazlett is a writer and former journalist and court information officer. She lives in South Milwaukee and is the author of the book Anatomy of a Trial, Public Loss, Lessons Learned from the People versus O.J. Simpson. We'll take one last break, and then we'll learn about how the success of Israeli television feeds American television. Lake Effect returns with that conversation in just a moment on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Most of us in the U.S. think that we, or possibly the Brits, make the best television in the world. But did you know that the very popular American television shows In Treatment and Homeland were both based on Israeli shows? There are many others, and it turns out that Israel exports more TV formats to other countries, including here to the U.S., than any other country in the world. And one of the people responsible for that is screenwriter, novelist, and former Israeli TV executive Ron Leshem. Not yet 40, the quality of Leshem's writing and his understanding of how TV works has made his work very desirable to Hollywood. Leshem was in Milwaukee at the end of January to deliver a lecture on the success of Israeli TV. He stopped by the studio first for a chat, and he explained what the Israeli television industry is doing to make their exports so compelling to the rest of the world.
This new era, it's like the golden age of television from the cable American show, is totally the new literature in my eyes. And we find here in the cable TV shows the most innovative and brilliant literature on screen, and we admire that and we want to be a part of that. But at the same time, the world is getting smaller, and as much as you see McDonald's or Starbucks everywhere, you see formats everywhere, and we are sharing formats. Sometimes you watch a show like Homeland, which is an original Israeli format, or House of Cards, which used to be a British format, and you don't know it was originally. And we take them and remake them because a good writing is a good writing, and we just find the ways to make the few changes that are needed for in a cultural way, or to adapt it in the right way. I think Israel is a laboratory, and that's really interesting because actually we do have a commercial networks, cable television, only for 20 years. We didn't really have anything. We only had the one channel till 1993. So we are really new in this thing, and we are very poor. I mean, my budget for an episode of drama would be like the budget of the beverages on the set of an American episode. But yeah, we have this huge desire, and I think we are good with stories. Israel is a crazy place for stories, for people who write. We are very similar to American audience, so we are a good laboratory for that. I think we are neurotic as the American audience, and we are a bit of paranoid sometimes, which makes it very relevant since 9/11 here.
I was interested in what you were saying about how you think that cable television in this country is sort of the new golden age. Are you talking about drama? Because there's a lot on cable that I would say doesn't really aspire to golden status.
Yeah, you know, well, for many years I was an executive, and I was doing also the reality shows, and in Israel too, the highest rating would go to reality shows like The Big Brother, which is, by the way, from Netherlands. And I'm always offended that it is They use the same name for our profession when we do drama and when we do these reality shows, because they're not. Yeah, I'm talking about the golden age of those high-end drama, and you can find on HBO and Showtime and FX and AMC, of course, which is very... Today is very, in the U.S., I think when we are coming to Los Angeles, what we hear from everybody these days, we don't want to be only plot-oriented, we want to be character-oriented. We want people to come back from episode to episode because they care for, or they find the lead character and the characters relatable, not always lovable. This is something that had changed. We used to do plot-oriented shows. We used to do lovable characters. So we get a chance to really to dare and to take risks. And that's the most amazing thing for writers. We find it here. I never expected Hollywood to be so open-minded to hearing ideas, so reachable. So you can get to anyone you want. You can tell and share stories. And we found some amazing partners there.
I'm surprised, actually, because I think Hollywood has a reputation for people who don't work in it as being a place that is risk-averse. I mean, that if it's not going to make money, I mean, if it's going to make money, great. But if it's not, you know, something that's commercially viable right off the bat, that they don't seem to be open to it. But you're saying, no, that's not true.
Well, I think in the networks for many years, in the big networks, commercial broadcasters, the competition killed the creativity. You don't see those good high-end drama on network today yet because they were so afraid to lose a moment of ratings and they couldn't take risks. At the same time, when HBO started and all the cable era started, they had to take risks because they wanted to break the China, right? Right now, they are less patient as they used to be, because when you had those shows that Breaking Bad was almost canceled after the first season and only the VOD figures, everything, they started understanding this powerful tool. But in so many amazing shows like The Wire, it took a few seasons to launch. And today, the competition in between the cable channels are also so high. They want you to bring the pilot that they cannot refuse to. And again, the competition makes it everything more edgy. And I think in that case, what's interesting about the Israeli market is that we are doing edgy mainstream almost always. We are taking risk. We need to be edgy. Our audience is neurotic. But at the same time, the television in Israel is totally campfire. It is the thing that if Israel is like 12 tribes and 36% of the population were born, even today, were born abroad. So the television is the one single cultural common thing between those tribes. And in order to succeed in Israel, because we are Israel is smaller than New Jersey. Israel has only 1.5 million households speaking Hebrew. So as we do television, it's like the size of the suburbs of Sacramento. We are not, so in order to succeed financially, we have to have 35% ratings. So we have to be mainstream. We have to talk to everybody, but at the same time, they get bored so easily. So we have to be edgy. This is what made us. We have a very interesting characteristic. I think the U.S. is today is more interested in formats that are like Homeland, the Israeli format, that are more related to espionage and security, national security issues. And right now we are trying to sell other stuff that I think we can contribute with too. In Treatment, that was aired on HBO, was also an Israeli format. But many of those Israeli formats that you see on screen today are all related to the post-trauma of 9/11, like Hostages that CBS aired this year.
Going back to what you were saying about character in all of this, that you have the formats, but that these are character-driven shows. The situation is something that we recognize culturally, but we need to care about the characters as well. How do you do that in Israel when you have such a diverse population? And as you say, you only have 1.5 million homes that are speaking Hebrew.
Oh, that's a tough question.
Yeah, how do you get all of those other people to care?
I think, first of all, personally, I always choose something I want to research. if I want to research how I can take a teacher, a science teacher, and make him a head of a cartel and the king of the most horrific mafia, I want to show it's like an algorithm. I want to prove it can happen. I want to research it. I want to live inside it. I'm writing things that I want to say and things that I want to try, mostly my alter ego, and things that are going to be that are going to have some kind of a new theme that should be researched. So it's usually it starts with that. But in Israel, I always feel an obligation to write something that is that makes the viewer, the audience, look at themselves in the mirror and be a bit worried or disturbed. And our reality, and in any kind of reality, I think this is drama and this is theater, and this is you have to make the audience uncomfortable with himself and checking himself and asking the questions that are relevant to himself. And also, I personally really love the values of relevancy in drama, and I want to dare and try new things.
You wear lots of different hats. You were talking before that you used to be an executive in Israeli television. You're mostly working as a writer now. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I resigned from my
office. You resigned from
job.
The stuff. So, yeah. Well, but does being an executive, it gives you an insight that a lot of writers wouldn't necessarily have. You know what it's like coming from the other direction. Does that help you or hinder you when you're working on a script?
It always makes you think, what would the executive say about it? You know what everyone would say about anything you do. It was very frustrating working on other people's stuff and working on so much things that weren't so important for me, like the Big Brother. But my first novel was adapted to a film and was nominated to the Academy Awards here in the U.S., I came back from Los Angeles, and at that night, it was 1 a.m., I text a message to my boss that I'm resigning because I want to be a writer, because I got the courage to say, well, I can take this risk and not be an employee of a huge corporate. And I think it always helps me that I have a bit of understanding of the big picture.
It doesn't get in your way creatively?
I guess it does. Maybe it does. But I mean, the thing is that I was so frustrated with writing books that is so solitude. And, you know, when you write a show, which could be the most, for me, the best literature ever, and it can be The Sopranos, and it can be Dexter, it can be Weeds, it can be whatever, you always sit in a room with eight people who are writing with you. There is a writing room, so suddenly you are not alone. And that was the new thing for me, because I got crazy. I started, when I was at home alone writing a novel, I started talking to the cats. I couldn't bear it anymore. So right now, when you sit in a room with eight people and one of them is really good with dialogues and one of them is very funny and one of them is very sensitive and one of them is best with thrillers and so... this is a working in a group. What makes it so unique, the cable drama, and I think that another change that happened in the U.S. You know how writers were so frustrated from cinema, and they were not significant in cinema. No one, I mean, they were the last in the chain, and it was a dictatorship of the director. And suddenly, a new era come. And we discovered that in television, we are the executive producers. The writer are choosing the director. The writers are the producers and the bosses of the whole thing. So it gives me still, especially the American way of doing things in television, gave me the ability to still be also an executive. That's the beautiful thing. I mean,
so you still get to wear both hats.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I really admire the American system in this way, and people like Howard Gordon, whom we worked on Homeland with. He's not only a brilliant writer, but he's a showrunner, and a showrunner means that both in 24 that he did to the networks before, and then when he was doing Homeland, he is a boss, but he is a creative executive, and he is a writer, but he sees the big picture and the budget and everything. That's the best profession I can imagine.
So do you hope to come here to do that? Or are you going to stay in Israel as a primary
resident? Well, I can't imagine myself living outside of Israel. I mean, I travel a lot. I love this. Israel is so tiny. You can cross it like 4 hours drive and you saw the entire country. So we have this kind of urge to fly all the time, to get out. We are surrounded by an atmosphere that makes us a bit paranoid about everything. We're trying to believe that we are Switzerland. We are naked on the beach all day. We have sex and parties and best restaurants in Tel Aviv and everything. While 20 minutes from us, people are executing women for adultery and executing gay people from the age of 16, and people are being slaughtered every day. And it gives you the urge feeling that everything can be gone in a second. So it makes you more more paranoid, but more full of life. It gives you the need to see the entire universe. So I'm traveling to, I've already seen 22 countries because of my novels, because whenever I'm, or my shows, whenever I'm invited to a festival, I take the chance to see the country. And that's the amazing thing, but I can't imagine myself living in, because I'm writing in Hebrew, this is who I am. And this is what I have, what is so important for me to say, to talk to the Israelis, everything. You always feel when you live in Israel that if you take the problems and the entire nation from your shoulder, you just, for a moment, you are not awakened there. The whole thing is going to collapse. And I'm addicted
ever
to
vigilant.
This way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So even as a tourist, I find myself like when I come to South Africa, when I come to places that everything is more complicated and explosive, it is more interesting for me than coming to Toronto, for example. I can't be in a too calm situation.
And Toronto is pretty calm. Well, I mean, I'm sure there are places in it that aren't, but not in the same way.
I just read it was one of the five best cities for young people in the world. So I guess it's a great place to live. And I have a Canadian family in my roots. I mean, my grandmother was born in Winnipeg, so everything else. But it's too calm for me.
Well, what are you working on now? What's going on creatively for you in terms of both novels or television?
Well, we are filming next month a pilot for NBC. It's an espionage story. And we found an amazing thing in NBC because the president of NBC Entertainment is the guy that came from Showtime. He was head of Showtime. He is responsible for such an amazing and daring like Dexter and Weeds and Shameless. And he's really trying to bring this quality to NBC. And we are filming a pilot with George Nolfi. He's a great director and showrunner. He did Ocean 12 and Born Identity. And that's a very new thing for us, learning from great people. And
on network television
on
here.
On network. It's going to be a risk, but we are excited about this. It's a new school for us.
Well, Ron, it has been such a pleasure to
Thanks.
Talk to you. And I wish you the best of luck with all of the new things.
Thanks so much for having me.
Israeli novelist, scriptwriter, journalist, and former television producer Ron Leshem spoke with us at the end of January. He was in town then to give a lecture on the success of Israeli television at the invitation of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. Leshem's books have been translated into 20 languages, and he's the winner of the Sapir Prize, Israel's top literary award. And that wraps it up for us today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. Lake Effect returns tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.